Hello. In this audio snippet, we will continue talking about taxation and how it should be defined or delimited in a new American Constitution. And we will more or less recap a lot of the things we've said before, but adding a few extra things. As we've said before, it's important that the new Constitution have a strong economic component. In other words, that it define clearly how government is supposed to interact with the economy, what type of economy system is considered constitutional, and what type of economy system is unconstitutional. The current Constitution is very, very lacking in that regard. And as we said before, it's ironic that the American Revolution, which started in great part because of the issue of taxation, led to a country being born and founded on a document that says practically nothing about taxation. And as we mentioned in a previous clip, there are only a few places where you see any direct references to taxation in the Constitution. And the biggest mention of it, you could say, is that the amendment that introduced the federal income tax, and but that happened many, many, many decades after the nation had been born, well into the beginning of the 20th century. So basically, we have a constitution that says nothing about taxation, puts no boundaries on how government can or cannot tax people and what taxes are for. And on top of that, it doesn't define things at a more general level regarding the economy. And as we also said before, it's kind of ironic that the most capitalistic nation in the history of mankind has a founding document that says practically nothing about capitalism, either for or against. And that's part of that big gaping hole that we have talked about, that the founding fathers left behind, that has led to the disaster we have now, where all these socialist, Marxist, Maoist liberals have been able to slowly move this country towards that type of system that not only brings economic oppression, it brings political oppression. But it's all because of that gaping hole. And some could argue, well, you can't blame the founding fathers for not worrying about capitalism versus Marxism or socialism or whatever, because Marxism didn't surface until the 19th century. And yes, you're right. In that sense, they didn't have to worry about that sort of thing in those days. But still, so you can say, okay, let's give them a pass on that. But you can still go back to the issue of taxation, which was relevant in 1775 and 1776. So if it was relevant then, they should have at least started to think about that. And if they had been as brilliant as conservatives always claim that they were, had they started thinking, going into the thoughts about, what a proper taxation system should look like and how the Constitution should define those parameters, then they would have broadened into making more defining more clauses in the Constitution regarding the economy in general and how the government is to interact with it. They were not visionary in that sense. They had some philosophical baggage that we haven't talked about in detail that just kept them from making that leap into a more advanced type of constitution. So they got stuck in the ground with a very poorly written, poorly designed, poorly thought out document. And we're living with the consequences of that to this day. And as we've said before, the philosophical baggage that these men had can be summarized with a word that starts with the letter P. and in a more in a broader sense with a word that starts with the letter E. But we're not going to talk about that this time. Hopefully, we'll do so in a future audio clip. So these men were very limited, and as we also said before, their incursion into the economic realm or the taxation realm was so limited, not only in the Constitution itself, but in their own thinking, that they didn't even bother to define the right to property in the Constitution. They were more worried about defining the right to bear arms, to have a gun, than the right to life or the right to property. And not that there's anything inherently wrong with the right to bear arms, but to have that as the second amendment in the Bill of Rights, like the second most important right that a human being can have after the First Amendment, freedom of speech, is ludicrous. It just reflects the lack of cogent, generic thinking that these men had. So they were not as brilliant as people make them out to be. And I would dare say that they were brilliant in the sense of just raw intellectual power. And that gets reflected in many of their writings. When you see the Federalist Papers and all these other early documents, you see brilliance. But it's just raw brilliance that is never really applied. It's like having a car that can go 160 miles per hour, but you only drive it, you never drive it beyond 40 miles per hour. So the potential is there. You can kind of see it. You can feel it. But these men were never able to take off. So they never really provided anything profound that could have saved us or helped us not be in the situation we're in right now. So that's why we are spending some time talking about taxation and some economic principles that need to be embedded in the Constitution so that we can safely say the Constitution promotes capitalism and a more or less a free market economy, and making it much more difficult for these Maoists, these socialist thinkers, Marxist thinkers that are running about, making it more difficult for them to do damage, because we would have a constitution we can go back to and say, hey, no, this is how it's supposed to be. This is the metaphysically correct way to have an economic system that leads to prosperity for everybody. And as we've also said before, when we say capitalism, please don't think of the stock market. The stock market is probably one of the most anti-capitalist institutions in America. It's a despicable system, and it doesn't really reflect capitalism, and that's why if you go into Wall Street and talk to all these people, you will find that the vast majority of them are true blue Democrat liberals. And if you would think that if Wall Street was real capitalism at its purest form, then you would have people who would be for free markets and have a quote more conservative mindset. But no, they are socialists and liberals, because Wall Street is anything but capitalism, and it should be destroyed and remade in a completely different way, with boundaries that should be and will be in the new American Constitution, so that it can really be a capitalist organization. So we said before in the previous clip that the new Constitution will have a system where only individual income will be taxed, and business income or business profit will not be taxed. And that would seem unfair to some people, especially those with a socialist mindset. But we have to remember, a company is not a person. It's just an entity. It's not like the company's not a person becoming rich. The riches come when the money is transferred from the company to people. That's when people start getting rich. As long as the money is sitting inside a business bank account, no one is any richer. And please forget the current system with the stock market, where if a company has a lot of promise, the stock prices start to rise and people start getting rich off of just the price of the stock. So that system would be gone. So it's basically, forgetting Wall Street and that mechanism, if money is sitting inside a business bank account, no one is any richer. It's just equity, money that's being used in an engine of production. And people only become rich when they can take from that pot of money and make it their own. And that's when it becomes taxable. And when you tax it as business income and then tax it when it becomes personal income, you're doing double taxation. That's one of the principles that the Constitution will have, that any type of bill that promotes a tax that leads to double taxation will automatically be unconstitutional. So that's why we need to prevent businesses being taxed. But then the problem becomes then people can try to turn a business into some sort of artificial tax shelter. But we gave an example in the previous clip of somebody trying to do that, say, like making up, creating a false company just to spend, to do his personal spending through the company, so that officially, you know, he's giving money to the company spends it for him, but because he gave it to the company, it's no longer taxable because it went from being income to being equity, business equity, that's not taxable. So he put it in the business to protect it and spent that money on personal stuff, but claiming it to be business expenses. And we gave the example, and I hope it made sense, that it doesn't work out if we add a restriction that if a company has losses, those losses do become income to the people who own that company. So if a company has a loss of $100,000 for the year and it's owned by three people, you know, same or four people, let's say, then each of them will be... it's like $25,000 will be added to their disposable income for tax purposes. So if they put money into, let's say they put $200,000 each into the business. So that money became sheltered, you could say, from taxation because it's now business equity, which is not taxable according as per this new constitution. Then out of those $200,000, if the business lost $100,000 in total, that's $25,000 for each. That means that out of those $200,000 that they put into the company, $25,000 become disposable income. So it's, in other words, it's as if they only put $175,000 at the start of the business, and the other $25,000 become income that will be taxed. So by applying that principle, then no one can really set up a false tax shelter, a fake company just to protect their income from being taxed. But now the question then becomes, what happens in other less artificial scenarios, let's say when someone is working for a legitimate company and starts getting these perks, these extra benefits that come with the job, that's when it gets a little bit iffy, and the Constitution has to kind of create a demarcation to make sure that no one tries to take advantage of this whole thing to avoid paying taxes. So for example, let's consider a case where an employee is working for a company. And when he was hired, he was such a popular candidate, and several companies wanted him to work for them. And the company that won out, that got his services, offered him a company car, let's say, a luxury company car. And let's say this guy has to travel, within that city or that state. And the car is like an extra help for him to go visit different branches of the company in different parts of the state or whatever. So there's a practical purpose for the car. But the car, even though it's owned by the company, is his for all intents and purposes, in the sense that he takes it to work, uses it to do his all his business meetings, and then takes it home on the weekend and goes to the beach with his family in that car, or you know, takes long trips in the countryside with the car, because the car is his to be used. So that's an example of a perk. And the problem is that in those cases, the person is beginning to receive an extra income, but because it's coming in a non-salary sort of way, it becomes invisible for tax purposes. And the Constitution should make it very clear that if the company is making an expense on behalf of an employee, but it's an expense that serves a personal purpose in the employee, not a company purpose, in a very direct sense. It's not related to helping the process of production or whatever in the company. It's just benefiting the employee personally. Then that is taxable income. So in other words, it should be considered as extra salary. So there should be some way. So companies, if they do this, would have to report that when this employee uses the car on weekends because he's using it for personal stuff, then the cost that the company incurs in terms of depreciation and all that will be treated as extra income to the employee. And because it's extra income, then the employee will have to pay taxes on it. Because at that point, money is being taken from equity, from business equity, and becoming personal equity or personal income. And every time that happens, then it should be recorded and it should be taxed. And the Constitution should make it very clear that anyone who doesn't respect that will be penalized. And there are other types of benefits that you can take and apply in this way. For example, life insurance. Let's say that you get life insurance with the job, and that doesn't benefit the company in any personal direct way. It doesn't benefit the business of the company. It's a personal thing that affects the employee at a personal level. So therefore, the whatever the company is paying out in life insurance for this employee should be considered additional income. So it should be reported as extra income for the employee, and then the employee will have to pay taxes on that. And therefore, so all these extra little benefits that get added to a person's salary, you could say, should be treated as taxable income. And this doesn't include cases, for example, where let's say the company pays for a trip for the employee to go to a seminar to attend the seminar that where he'll be getting training or whatever that is very specific for his job. In that case, it would be unfair to punish the employee and have the cost of that trip be added to his income, declared income, and you know him having to pay taxes on that trip, 20%, as we've said, as a symbolic percentage, because maybe he didn't even want to go to that seminar, but he's being sent to learn something specific to the company. In those cases, obviously, then that is the company investing in that employee so that he can produce more. It's not an expense. It's not like they paid for him to go to Disney World with his family. That has nothing to do with the company. That's a personal trip. So that is taxable income. This is very job specific. And in that case, it's just the company investing to make itself better by giving training employees so that they will be more productive or whatever. So that is a different story. But the problem that we've had in America is that we've begun, and this is a very socialist thing, to bind work to benefits. And that muddled things to such an extent that we now have the mess that we have now. And the biggest benefit, the biggest problem benefit that the American economic system has is health insurance. And one thing that many Americans don't realize is how abnormal health insurance is in the United States when as compared to other countries. And most Americans don't realize this because Americans are very myopic in terms of their awareness of what happens in other parts of the world. We in America are not very geographic. We are a bit geographically challenged. So, for example, if you ask an average American, you know, if you show them a map of the world and say, hey, point to Iraq, I doubt that I would be surprised if more than 25% are able to pinpoint Iraq, at least, you know, in a general sense, on the map, even though we've had two wars there already in recent decades. Most Americans, America's so so self-focused, and in part because America has been the most important country on the face of the earth for decades and decades. And most of the time, people outside the U.S. are worried about what's going on in America than America worried about what's going on in other countries because of how important America is. So we've become very self-absorbed in that sense, and we have no awareness of what happens in the rest of the world. That muddles a lot of our thinking. And that's also part of what leads to liberalism, to white liberals, being so duped by all the propaganda that they hear when they hear about racism in America and the injustice and the poverty and the oppression of the capitalist elite. And when I hear them talk and say all these things, I go, my goodness, these people don't understand what's going on in the rest of the world. If America is such a racist nation, why are people coming in droves through the southern border, people who are not white Anglo-Saxons, coming through the southern border to try to, you know, make a living here? Could it be because they face a certain level of racism or discrimination or oppression that is so bad that they have to come get the oppression of the white man here in America? And when socialists or white liberals start talking about the poverty and all this in America, I always hear these commercials about one in five children in America faces hunger. And when I hear those commercials, I go, oh my goodness, then we are a third world country. We're worse than a third world country. These people have no idea about what hunger is. To them, hunger is a kid wanting a Snickers bar and not being able to get it before 10 a.m. Break. I mean, that's hunger to them. They don't understand what real hunger is because America, being so egocentric, doesn't see what's going on in the rest of the world. America doesn't understand how racism operates in so many other parts of the world. In Japan, in the Philippines, in Spain, if you knew Americans how racist Spain is, Hispanics who go to Spain, when they go back to their countries, they always complain about how the Spaniards treated them like dirt. And we're talking about people who speak the same language, people who were conquered by the Spaniards. So there should be, you would think, of some sort of link, cultural linkage or bonding happening. And no, if Americans knew what's going on in Europe, in soccer or football fields, black players having bananas thrown at them, from the crowd. Imagine that happening here. And I'm not talking about something that happened 50 years ago. I'm talking about recent things. So America is very, very egocentric, very unaware of what's going on around the world. So we tend to to kind of over-exaggerate things, how bad things are here, and liberals use that as a weapon to then promote their agenda on people who are just too stupid or too ignorant to understand what's really going on in the world. And one of the things that America is very unaware of is how, as I was saying, how abnormal health insurance is in this country. And the reason for that is that in America, if you go to a doctor or a dentist, the first thing that they ask you is, do you have insurance? And that's a normal thing in America, but that's very abnormal in most of the world. The problem is that we have tied insurance so deeply into healthcare that every health expense that we make is automatically associated to insurance. In other countries, it's not like that. In most countries, you know, if you go to the doctor, you have to, you know, you pay for your visit. He gives you a prescription. You go get the medicine at the pharmacy or, you know, with the chemist, and he gives you the medicine. You pay, how much it costs, and you go home. That's how it operates in most of the world. But in America, everything is insurance. Insurance. You go pay for your medicine, and insurance is involved, and it shouldn't be like that. And it got embedded into our system in a very dangerous way, and it began when insurance got tied to employment. And most people don't realize this, but before, like in the 19th century, there were some programs and certain things that people did to kind of have some form of health insurance. And then in the early 20th century, and it's kind of a very complicated story, but just to make it short, in the 1940s and 50s, we had basically an explosion of health insurance being connected to employment for three fundamental reasons. One was something that FDR, which stands for Fast Decline of the Republic, that when that bastard boy, polio boy, decided to impose wage and price restrictions. And this was because America had gone to war in World War II. And that created a lot of economic activity. And wages were rising significantly, and he and his Democrat bastards decided to, we have to control this. So they started imposing wage limits, so people couldn't make more than a certain amount of money, and the problem was that because then you had companies that wanted a certain candidate, but they couldn't pay them more than a certain amount because it was illegal to offer them more money, which is ironic because America had been in this artificially prolonged depression since 1929. FDR, son of a bitch, polio boy, came to power in 1933, and he stayed around until his death. Thank God he went and. Now it's burning in hell as we speak. It's under my feet. When that that polio boy took over, he did a lot of things that just made the depression just go on and drag on and on and on. He never got us out of the depression. That's a myth in American history that we get taught as kids, that FDR led the nation through the depression and led us out of it. No, he didn't. He prolonged it. Something that should have been like a 4 or 5 year hit at the most, and Herbert Hoover's also to blame for his idiocy while he was around in between 29 and 32. So he made it worse too, but then FDR took it to a whole new level, and we just kept going on and with this economic depression on and on and on for no reason at all until World War II came. And that's when our economy got activated, because this demand that had been artificially suppressed for so long just, you know, came to life, and America just started producing. So the thing is that as we began to produce more, as the economy got better, this polio boy decided, no, Americans are making too much. So he put wage controls. And because of that, employers, as I said, could not give more money to their employees. And so what they had to do is kind of like do it backdoor style. So they decided, okay, well, I cannot give you more money, but I can give you an intangible thing such as health insurance. So that's how slowly health insurance began to get tied with employment. And the other thing that happened was that at the same time, legislators were at the state level and the federal level had decided that any income that's received, let's say, through health insurance is not taxable income. And it eventually became law, explicit law, that any health benefits that you got from work would not be considered income that is taxable. So therefore, it just created this just perfect tax shelter. According to a study from the Congressional Budget Office, semi-useless institution, I would dare say, but the Congressional Budget Office had a study in 2013, if I'm not mistaken, and they estimated that the American government, in a sense, provides a $250 billion tax subsidy on health insurance or healthcare, health insurance alone. In other words, if people, instead of getting that health insurance from their job, you know, got paid, and then if they got, you know, they got paid that amount in money, and then they went and got the same insurance, then because it came in as money first, it would be taxable, and it would be taxable at the level of around $250 billion that the government's not getting in tax revenues because of that backdoor payment. So it became fashionable and also for the employees better. Okay, yeah, you're not going to give me more money. Give me health insurance, because I know that money that you give me through health insurance will not be taxable. I won't have to pay any taxes on it. So because of those factors, and also a third factor was unions. In the 40s and 50s, there was this explosion of unions in the country. The union movement became very strong. And when it was declared that health insurance was a negotiable item in labor negotiations, then unions started taking that as an important tool to negotiate. So they started asking and demanding for health insurance for the union members, and that just added to that. So slowly everybody got infected with the health insurance bug. And what happened slowly is that health insurance, which is intended to be something for a catastrophic event, became a way to pay for daily events. It's almost, imagine how ridiculous the scenario is in America, how abnormal it is. Just to give you a sense, it might sound like an exaggeration, but it's not really that much of an exaggeration. Think of food insurance. Let's say that instead of you paying your, you know, for your groceries, every time you go to the supermarket, you go get your groceries in the cart, and then you go to the register and pay and go home. And let's say that instead of that, you paid food insurance. So you're paying these premiums, and then you go to the supermarket and you know that you can get vegetables for free, and you can get spaghetti with a 20% copay and so forth. And you go and start buying your food like that. That's exactly what's going on with medicine, with daily things, not with like somebody getting cancer or some sort of catastrophic disease and having to go to hospital and having all these extra expenses and things like that. Insurance is not for that in America. Insurance is just to go get your aspirin or whatever, your Vicodin, or because that's how embedded the insurance system is. And the problem with that is that because now instead of paying for our medical services the way normal people would, we're paying into this pot, and this pot is offering these plans with all these options. Then what happens is you start paying a fixed amount. It doesn't matter if you go to the grocery store, let's say, using the analogy, it doesn't matter if you go to the grocery store or not. It doesn't matter if you get sick or don't get sick. You're still paying this big amount of money every month into this pot. And what happens is, let's say you have a hankering for a tiramisu cake, and you would not have bought it normally, but because your plan says that you get, you know, 20% copay or whatever on a tiramisu cake, then you say, okay, might as well get it. So because I'm already paying into this thing. So what happens is you artificially start increasing demand for medical services. And doctors see that in hospitals and go, okay, oh, you're insured. Awesome. Your plan allows you to be tested for this, this, and that. I'm not 100% sure you need these tests, but we got a result here that might indicate that you might have osteothrombosis of the rib cage or something like that. And it's not likely, but there's a slight percentage of possibility that you might get it. But your plan covers that, the test. We can test for that. So they test the guy for that unnecessary, you know, scenario. He comes up negative, but now the hospital can go and charge that to the insurance company, and the insurance company has to pay for that. And because the insurance company is shelling out all this money to pay for all these unnecessary tests, they have to raise premiums on everybody else to cover it. Because one of the myths that Americans have, and this idiotic myth, that health insurance companies are evil, greedy monsters that are making $100 gazillion a year and not paying the poor little people who get sick when they get sick. That's the furthest from the truth. Insurance, I think, on average makes, I could be wrong on this, but last I heard, insurance companies make a profit of around 3%. I mean, that's their margin of profit. We're not talking about 25-30%, because they have to pay for so many expensive things. And because they're paying for this, then the drug companies go, okay, there's a market for unnecessary drugs. So let's make a drug for this condition. And then they start advertising it on television. And people go, oh yeah, I might have that. That might be a good thing. Maybe they don't need the medicine, but you know, they've been showing it on television. They go, oh, is this covered? Oh yes, it's covered. Okay, I'll get it. So now, so we start this vicious cycle of artificial demand. And then the artificial demand creates supply, and the supply, you know, is fed by this demand. We start this vicious cycle of price increases, and then on top of that, we have all these greedy lawyers. And hopefully one of these days we'll have an audio clip on how the new constitution will change the legal profession. I know most lawyers will not like hearing this, but I know that if we are going to rescue America, we have to change the legal profession constitutionally, to make it so that only decent people can work there. And we can do that by a very simple rule that we'll talk about in a future clip. If we add that to the Constitution, I can assure you that the legal profession will get cleaned up in a flash. But that's for another clip. The thing is that we have all these vultures, all these lawyers, just waiting and waiting for some sort of a medical mistake. And if they, somebody makes a medical mistake, boom, they swoop down, convince the patient, hey, malpractice, medical malpractice, and then let's sue the hospital for $15 billion because your toenail didn't grow back. And then, you know, then the hospital has to spend money on their legal team and go to court. All this extra, all these resources that society is pouring into litigation that could be used to produce new things, to provide food for the needy, for that, you know, kid that's hankering for a Snickers bar, you know, that liberals are so bent on. So we're diverting all these, and that, so that creates the need for hospitals and doctors to be extra careful, because they know that if they make one tiny mistake, there will be, you know, this flock of vultures, you know, swooping down on them to sue them for millions. So they say, oh, I have to, I'm sorry, but we'll need to do this extra test, this extra test. So all these extra tests are required to cover their behinds in case of a malpractice lawsuit. So we just create the snowball effect. So we have, it all starts with insurance being part, becoming part of employment. And the moment we made this cultural connection between health insurance and employment, it just began this snowball effect where we are being given a product even if we don't need it, which historically was added to our package of goods and services, of salary, you could say our salary package, because of Polio Boy, the bastard who's burning his house as we speak, thankfully. He's screaming, and I rejoice over that. So bastard Polio Boy imposed these artificial restrictions on wages, which led to employment and insurance being tied in together artificially. This was an unnatural thing. And now we have all these extra costs. And then old bastard care came along, which added all these extra demands on insurance policies. The insurance policies must have this, this, and that, and the other. And because they think that everything is magical, then insurance companies will magically provide all these extra things that are demanded by law for free. And that's not going to happen. They have to raise their premiums because they are a business. So there's this horrible snowball effect. And now insurance, ever since Obastrid Care came along in America, insurance premiums have gone up dramatically. Health insurance is very expensive now because of that bastard boy that soiled the White House between 2009 and 2016. But he was able to do that only because we were already with the cancer of health insurance. So we need to extricate that connection that we have between employment and health insurance. So the tax shelter will be gone. So again, anything that is provided to the employee for his personal benefit is no longer business equity. It's now individual income, and should be taxable. So if the employer comes along and offers you health insurance and you take it, then you're going to have to pay taxes on the equivalent amount of what the company is paying for that health insurance. And believe you me, the moment that starts happening, then people will suddenly say, okay, I really don't need health insurance as much as I thought. And just so you have an idea of how much of a cancer health insurance has become, last I heard, like many years ago, like 10 years ago, that 1/6 of the gross domestic product of the United States goes to health care costs. And I think it rose to around 20% around 2020, last year, especially with all the nonsense with the virus. So we're a society that spends one out of every $6 on healthcare. And when you hear about that, you go, my goodness, this must be the apocalypse. Everybody must be dropping dead on the streets. A society that, you know, and we're not talking about a tiny GDP. You know, I forget how, I could be wrong. I think that American GDP is $14 trillion. And if it's not that, I apologize. I should know that. But it's a whole bunch of money. And 1/6 of that whole bunch of money is going into medical care. I mean, and we're not that sick. We're really not that sick. but we have created this artificial system where there's this fear, and it just this it's the cycle. Everything becomes so expensive medically that you go, oh, I have to have insurance to be covered. So people pour more money into the insurance pot, which adds more money, more demand for medical services, which then increases the prices even more, and then you need more insurance, and you go on and on like that. It's unnatural for a country of people who are really very healthy. I mean, compared to the rest of the world, we're very, very healthy. And it's not because we're spending so much money on health insurance. It's despite our healthcare expenses. So there's something wrong. And there's also another problem when everything is tied to health insurance, then we add a whole layer of bureaucracy, because when you go to the doctor and you say, oh, I have a plan with such and such company, that's my insurer, they have to fill out, the people at the clinic have to fill out the forms, all the complicated forms to send out to the insurance company to collect on the services they provided you. It just creates this extra layer of bureaucracy. And it creates kind of like a Jekyll and Hyde situation with doctors and their staff when it comes to uninsured patients. Because on the one hand, an uninsured patient is kind of like a blessing in the sense that they don't have to fill out paperwork. You know, he just comes in, does his consultation, whatever, his visit, and then he leaves, and you know, he pays and he leaves, and that's it. As opposed to an insured person where you have to fill out all this extra stuff. But then on the other hand, there's this thing that they don't like uninsured patients because they know that with an uninsured patient, money counts. So they can't be demanding, say, oh, you should get this test. You should get this test. They can't get more money out of the guy because he's not insured. So it's like a blessing and a curse to them. But so we've created this layer where imagine society spending all this time filling out insurance forms. Imagine how hellish life would be if that you had to do that when you went to the supermarket. Instead of just going to the counter, register, and paying, having to fill out all these forms and knowing, okay, this one, I on this hamburger, I have to pay 20% copay. On this shampoo, I have to pay 10%. All this complicated stuff. And that's where we are. And it all started because we allowed companies to provide personal benefits without taxing it. So that should disappear under the new constitution. And I believe, I don't know if it should be illegal, but I believe it should be strongly encouraged in the new constitution that employers not pay employees in ways other than a straight up salary. In other words, no extra benefits, no perks, no nothing. Just, you know, you do your work, you get paid your salary, and you do whatever you want with it. If you want to get health insurance with it, go ahead, get it. And it's so sad in this country that, you know, because insurance is so tied to your employment, if you lose your job, you lose your insurance. And why is that? Why do we have to get insurance through the employer? What is so special about the employer that he has to become the intermediary between us and the insurance company? Why? Again, it's all very unnatural. It came out of historical reasons, you know, starting with Polio Boy, and the decisions he and the people of his time made that led to what we have now. But we should not have any of that under the new constitution, because, again, we only want to tax personal income. Any money that's tied in a business equity cannot be taxed. And the moment that money gets taken from equity and converted into personal individual income, then it's taxable, no matter what form it has. And companies should have this. We should be very strict with companies when it comes to that. If they're giving an employee a company car, then they should measure how much of the car is being used for personal purposes by the employee, and report it as extra income to the government. And I can assure you that because it can get very complicated, companies will just be very, very simple with it. You know, okay, we want you, my friend, okay, we're going to pay you extra. And you can, if you want, you can go get yourself a nice new car, but that's on your own. But you do have to know that to work for us, you will need a car to travel, and that's why we're paying you this extra money. Instead of having the company having to make all these convoluted calculations of how much depreciation of the car should be assigned as income, how much was used for business purposes, instead of all the complication, just give him the money and let him decide what to do with it. And then things will become much, much simpler. And health insurance should also be modified in the new constitution that I'm not too clear on how it should be done in a proper way, in a generic way, not just as a reaction to what's happening, but as a manifestation of a deeper principle that needs to be respected. And I haven't been able to get to that, but I believe that the new constitution should have something that says that any type of insurance, like health insurance, that it covers daily costs, like medical monthly visits and things like that, dental cleanings, things that are normal, that are not catastrophic or not some sort of accident, that sort of thing should be illegal. Health insurance should only cover unexpected events. Not if you know you're going to go to the doctor twice a year, to the dentist twice a year, that should not be insurable. It's just part of your cost of existence. But I'm not sure how to phrase that. What is the more general principle that's being violated when we allow health insurance to operate like this? I'm still not too clear on that, but I do believe that we should put something in the Constitution to prevent this happening in future. So I know this audio snippet went very long, and I didn't get a chance to talk about the other thing that I wanted to share on, but we'll leave it for the next snippet. I hope that you're seeing some ideas that we're kind of playing out or talking out about taxation, the relationship between government and companies, the relationship between companies and employees. And the Constitution should have these principles laid out in it. Instead of the right to bear arms and not letting military troops sleep in our houses, instead of having amendments like that, we should have something more general. And we should have economic policy that defines America for sure as a capitalist nation. And that doesn't mean that we will not have some sort of compassion in terms of helping the poor and things like that. But we'll talk about that in some other time. But we have to lay it down. The right to property should be in the Constitution for sure as one of the 10 pillars that we mentioned before. And we should have a system that says, hey, government does not have to a big role to play in the economy, and taxation should be simplified, and we should give people the freedom to produce and take away all these things that get into the economy that sap it out of its life, like health insurance, the health insurance system that we have in America today. So thank you. So we'll continue talking about all these things in future audio snippets.